If you're stressed or depressed, anxious or just need a rest. If you're into your sport and you want to perform at your best, take a breath, take a breath, take a breath.
Tim and Matt, and we've got a special guest today, Craig Phillips.
Welcome. Thanks, Matt. Been many years, yeah.
I was trying to work it out. 1990-something we worked together.
Yes.
In dance medicine. Craig is the founder of Clinical Pilates.
Yes, indeed. We brought it to Australia in the late 80s, and it was just one of those things, being a recycled ballet dancer. We'd done it for many years. As dancers, I went back to physio. I graduated in 1987, and it was actually an orthopedic surgeon, Jim Garrick, from San Francisco, was starting up sports medicine. It was when sports medicine was starting. And he mentioned Pilates, and I went, oh, we did that. So I had a chat to him, and he said, we've put Pilates into the sports medicine department and dance medicine at St. Francis Hospital in San Francisco. Come and have a look at what we do. So I was given a grant from the Australia Council. They'd already helped recycle me, and went across and spent quite a bit of time working with them, and then also working with some of the original Pilates masters who are still alive, and did that over quite a few years. We set up a similar setup at Paran Sports Medicine here in Melbourne in the late 80s, about 88 I think, and started doing the same thing with sports people. Jim Garrick's thing was, you've got high level elite sportsmen. We were working with the 49ers in San Francisco. Then he said, these guys are completely useless. They fall over, and if they could do what the dancers could do, I think they'd have less injuries and perform better, because they were rubbish. He was way ahead of his time, and then we found the same as we did with AFL players here, that we were getting similar sorts of situations where they were just very strong but very inefficient, and we're working on that to this day. We've got some PhDs running on strength and conditioning and efficiency. Is that the short background?
Because no one had really heard of Pilates back then, but we had all these sort of elite sports people coming in, as well as the dancers. Some of the guys from Hawthorn Footy Club came in, and these are guys who can do 1,000 sit-ups with weights behind their head, but you got them doing some simple basic Pilates stabilizing thing and they're shaking like a leaf.
That's right, yeah.
And you go, okay, this is different.
We had Hawthorn, North Melbourne and Collingwood, that's right.
You were dancing Australian Ballet.
Prior to that.
Became a physio.
Correct. So 10 years with Australian Ballet, was a dancer, and then left in 83 to physio, graduated first degree anyway, 87, 88, it's on the wall. 88, there you go, they let me out in 88.
We're in Craig's office at Dance Medicine in South Yarra. Was it a fascination with Pilates, or you could see the clinical benefit in it? Or?
I think it had something more to offer at that stage. Working with dancers was part of it. You know, the dancers wanted to get onto it, and we could see benefits. But what we were seeing with the people in the US, and finding the same thing with the AFL guys here, that there was another aspect rather than just getting strong, because we had this idea of get strong and you won't get injured. And of course, even back then, the get strong, won't get injured model has been disproven time and time and time again. As soon as you're starting strength and conditioning, the injury rates go up, and you know, strong injured sports people are the norm, yeah. Which puts a big question mark on it. We've now got a PhD running that actually shows what we're doing on the efficiency model with subgrouping provides a better performance outcome than standard strength and conditioning training. So we actually have numbers that shows degradation in performance with standard strength and conditioning, which will upset a few people, but it's a PhD. Sam Leslie, colleague here at Melbourne University, is doing that at the moment. We've got the numbers. I was asked to present that after the last World Rugby Cup in Wales, saying rugby players should train like ballet dancers. They said, good on you. You've now got the keynote presentation. So that is online.
Well, that's the first big statement for this interview. Yeah, I think there'll be a few, actually.
You look at the old David Campese little step he used to do. That was a bit of dance almost.
Yeah.
When he used to run around people.
In that case, it was the VASM conference. That was nearly 2 years ago now. The short story on that, well, what is the most expensive sport injury? And you've got to put ACLs up there and up near the top of the list. And the predominant mechanism of injury, they just fall over. Nobody hits them. And YouTube these days, you can get and find hundreds of videos of people just falling over, which we did. The front thing from there was the fact, well, why shouldn't we be looking at an industry where the incidence of ACLs are very, very low? And if you look across the entire professional ballet dancing world, the incidence of ACLs across all the professional companies per annum, and that's thousands of professional ballet dancers who are turning, twisting, lumping, jumping, landing every day. You could count them on one hand. The Royal Ballet, I think, had 3 in 13 years. Australian Ballet's had about 2 in 10 years. American Ballet Theatre, I think, has had about 1 or 2. I mean, they're virtually non-existent. Dancers don't do their ACLs, and there's lots of literature to that point.
Right.
So there was a correlation, rugby dancers in tights. They're halfway there. So I did survive that. But it was looking, again, at this efficiency model. But getting back to what you wanted to talk about was breathing. One of those things with breathing is, first, you can't do without it, but also looking at whether we do expiration on effort, inspiration on effort. There's a lot of work looking at strength and conditioning, even in women's health, but the expiration, the forced expiration, does actually cause a lot of problems. We've got a fabulous video we use, if you want to YouTube it, called CrossFit P, and it's basically about females who are incontinent doing high-level weight training and urinating everywhere, which is not doing their pelvic floors the world of good. Mm. Weightlifters, males, the same thing. Rectal prolapses, erectile dysfunction, stress urinary incontinence, same thing with this forced expiration. The generation of high intra-abdominal pressure, bracing, does cause a lot of problems with hernias, prolapses, urinary incontinence, sexual dysfunction. So there's a lot of literature coming out around this. Somehow it did get brought into, and it was looked back in the 1600s by Valsalva. People heard of the Valsalva maneuver. Yeah. Weightlifters, you know, bracing against a closed glottis can pop off their retina. It has become quite a moot point. Weightlifting, and they still do it. We have pictures of rectal prolapses from people forced expiring with great loads, and we won't put those up, no. But after every Olympics or Games, just get on and look up weightlifting accidents. You see episodes of people urinating and worse as weightlifters, which is a bit of a problem.
So you're talking about that Valsalva manoeuvre, or contracting.
That sort of, you know, bracing.
Strong bracing contraction.
Yeah.
Is that force contracting and exhalation on?
It's the core stability model. If you get out there and look at planking and people doing core stability training, they're generating these high intra-abdominal pressures. It's about the same pressure you generate during childbirth.
Right.
About 300 to 400 mil intra-abdominal pressure, millimetres of mercury, versus your normal tidal expirations, about 20 to 40. So 10 times that is going to lead
to problems. So what you're saying
problems.
Is that doesn't work, that system, or you're finding?
It fails.
It fails.
Yeah, the system fails.
When I first learned about the breathing work and understanding the diaphragm, then people were saying really engage your core and suck navel into spine, for example.
Which
and
is
then,
what people associate with Pilates, is that core stability. I mean, I get patients referred to me, the doctor says, oh, you need core stability.
That was the paradox for me, was like, well, if I'm going to do that, then how do I then use my diaphragm to breathe, given that's the primary breathing muscle? And I'm not a physio, so the question was something that I couldn't answer people. Does that mean that understanding has now gone beyond that?
Yeah, Pilates wasn't about core stability originally. I can take blame for this one, but they first heard about neutral spine, the course at transverse, all that in about 1993, presented at a conference in New York. Because Pilates was originally flat lumbar spine, flexion, went to this neutral spine from the 1990s onwards, and we spent a lot of time teaching that around the US.
And that Jalen Richardson was
the Jalen Richardson
to that.
Yeah, so all the transversus work. The navel to spine, as you say, what that does is use a lot of external obliques and internal obliques, and that actually is what stops you using your diaphragm. So that bracing navel to spine is a flawed cue. In fact, all of the transversus abdominis work has been disproven now, much to the chagrin of many, but I looked at one master's I was doing, ultrasounding every patient we had, and we looked at lots of these trying to replicate a lot of this work on transversus, and we couldn't replicate it. I did give up. I've got hundreds of videos, but a chap called Gary Allison, who's the professor of physio at Curtin University in Western Australia, did continue. We were both going, there's something wrong with this model, and we found that it was flawed, and he's since published that it was flawed. It's not a corset. It only works on one side at a time, so it's to do with weight transfer. You move a limb on one side, the opposite side reacts, so it's not this corset model.
That's it. External.
Internal obliques, transversus, the whole lot.
The whole thing. That we think of as the core.
As the core doesn't truly exist, if you're not moving. It's really good if you're sitting still and you decide not to move. So this is also proven by Sue Morris, who published later on looking at limb movement. She looked at upper limb, and they'd hypothesized in the original research that it did the corset. When they actually tested it, they found the movement was on the opposite side. This corset doesn't exist. So that's Sue Morris, Gary Allison. It's published research. So we've all buried the transversus core stability model because it never actually proved better performance. It will still persist over years. And Joel Richardson, Paul Hodges, they've all well and truly moved away from that now, the original researchers.
Is it interesting how the research, but it takes a long time to sort of filter in, and then it takes a long time to filter out.
Yeah, it was what was called observational research. They made an observation and went, this muscle's not working, people have low back pain, they must go together. But we found it was a non-correlate observation, in the same as, well, I drive a car in the rain and I got got a flat tyre, therefore driving cars in the rain give you flat tyres. It doesn't necessarily correlate. We just observed it in a few people and that must be the rule. There's a lot more behind that too. The nerve supply to the anterior abdominal wall comes from the thoracic spine, not the lumbar spine. We upset a lot of people there saying, well, how does your lumbar low back pain stop a thoracically innervated muscle group? The whole lot comes from T6 to T12. So it got more confusing and interesting, and there was lots of fights.
Wow.
I think we won.
How does that translate into your actual work, then the clinical work with the Pilates?
The work we're doing at the moment is looking at subgrouping, and this is the focus. There's been a huge focus towards exercise. You can pick up just about any problem these days and they include exercise, you know, cancer, respiratory disease, mental health, orthopedics. You look at that and they've all got and exercise. With that, you've got two groups. You've got people that get off your ass and do something and be better than doing nothing. So that's that group of exercise. And that's what they found with a lot of the original transversus. People just doing exercise rather than doing nothing. Of course, they got better. And there'll be a large group of people that will get better with just that approach. The next level on from that is looking at patients that don't respond to generic exercise. They need something specific. And there's another distinct subgroup in that, and that's where we're looking at this chronic complex pain model, which is terrifying the health insurers, where, you know, 80% of your costs sit above that 20% line. And in fact, if you want to get even more scared, Medibank Private currently spends 65% of their funds on 3% of their people. HBF, another fund, they spend 40% of their money on 1% of their people. So up there, there's a scary number that are getting larger with the aging population. So it's all those figures adding up. I've got them just a little bit nervous. We're seeing our funds going to go up and they're only going to go one way. It's coming back to the exercise thing of still putting exercise in there, but being much more selective on how we select exercises that are going to be beneficial versus non-beneficial. So that's what our research is focused on at the moment. We're working with the health funds on this because we can actually predict the outcome of surgery based on this model or suitability for surgery. And that's a big one at the moment with the aging population, people going in for joint replacements, knee replacements. If you want a nice figure, 2003, Kurtz published a paper looking at the trend of knee replacements. This was in the US, but it does correlate to Australia and Britain. And they said between 2005 and 2030, there was going to be a 670% increase in joint replacements in that time frame. That was revisited in 2013. They said we're right on track. In fact, we're probably exceeding that at the moment. Even then, looking at it, they found that 44% of those joint replacements were actually indicated, 34% were totally non-indicated, and 21% were pretty questionable. So we're looking more than 50% of these things don't really need doing.
It's not something you do for fun either.
$35,000 a throw, no guarantee. So this area we're working on is saying, can we use exercise to actually set this prediction model in place, give them a specific exercise program, and the specificity comes down to rather than tissue.
So this is the second group you're talking about will benefit from specific exercises.
Yes, so specific exercise, and it's just using a directional modelling, which we can use movement-based classification as opposed to structure-based classification, which every time you now look at a paper, you cannot identify which structure is causing the pain. All the shoulder tests, they used to say which structure is causing the pain, have now been misproven. Orthopedic tests for hips, knees, spine, none of these tests can identify the actual structure.
But people, I think, instinctively want that. Is it the disc or the joint? It's like, you've got lower back pain,
yeah,
so we're going to fix that.
Could be the disc, could be the facet, could be all these things in there.
It doesn't actually really matter. As you used to say, we don't treat the x-ray, we don't treat the scan.
No, treat the patient. We do get patients that very nicely the scan fits the patient. Lovely. That's about 10%.
But it was also your work on heel spurs in ballet dancers.
Yep.
Oh, look, on x-ray, there's this big heel spur. We'll take the heel spur off. It makes no difference.
Made no difference. Yeah, they're now saying they make no difference. We were seeing it way back then. I mean, Rochelle Bookbinder, a well-known rheumatologist here in Melbourne, was on the news last week, again, pushing this thing about exercise versus structurally based management, surgery, and getting away from the medical surgical model for better outcomes. So this is a huge push, the question being, how do you actually pick and match the patient to the intervention? That's sort of what we're doing at the moment, because if you can avoid a joint surgery, that's great. Spinal surgery, same sort of thing. Mixed in amongst all this are these chronic complex patients. Getting back to your breathing thing, you find on top of this pain model, you've also got people sort of coming in with a list of symptoms, including breathing dysfunction, gut dysfunction, cardiac dysfunction, all the rest of it, which comes under a thing called dysautonomia. This quite often gets covered with lists of different names: fibromyalgia, chronic regional pain syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, hyperventilatory syndrome, irritable bowel, postural orthostatic tachycardia, postural orthostatic intolerance. The list goes on. There's probably about 30 I can pick off the top of my head, but when you actually look at the list of symptoms, depending on which is predominant at the time as to how they get named, but the list of symptoms come under a title of dysautonomia. This has been well researched at UCL in London, University College. A chap called Rodney Graham is one of the leaders in this. We do have a unit at Melbourne University here run by Elspeth MacDonald, been looking at autonomic function for many years. And these autonomic patients turn up in these chronic disease models, very much so. They'll have altered breathing, which means your breathing is normally controlled by the automatic or the autonomic nervous system, the phrenic motor neuron. But if you've got to start controlling your breathing, there's something wrong. It's playing up. And it's usually not sitting alone. There'll be breathing, increased anxiety, adrenoreceptor response. You're all pumped up with adrenaline. Why? And these things are all very real.
These people are not having very much fun.
They're not having much fun at all.
We see them in clinic all the time.
Constantly in clinic. They've gone off and had the surgery, had the procedure. The knee was only just annoying, this other stuff.
We're talking about core stability and breathing, but obviously your work's gone a lot further than that. I guess rehabilitation, sort of clinical, ballet dance, sports medicine, and now...
You get dragged down the rabbit hole.
And that's an interesting thing about where Take a Breath has come from. We decided to start Take a Breath because we were both interested in breathing from different angles, from Chinese medicine and physio, and me from naturopathy, a psych background, sport, and then the Bateco style. But what we learned from understanding breathing, because of the role of diaphragm and we could consciously control it via training, is that it plays a much, much larger role in autonomic nervous system function. Or then we look beyond that at autonomic nervous system function, and we're both working, because of our illness background and then what we did professionally, we've both been working in chronic illness. It's interesting, we wanted Take a Breath to be about breathing, but more than that, we wanted it to be about health and lifestyle. How do we live a better life?
Yeah.
How do we find better quality of life, more freedom, the whole damn thing?
And this is where it's one of those triggers that there's something wrong. Phrenic motor neuron drives your diaphragm in response to basically how much oxygen you need in the system. It's automatic response. You need to leave it alone. Now, once that system starts being interfered with, it's a cascade of problems that then occur with it. We found the same thing, you know, looking at the Nijmegen questionnaire, one I showed you before. If you line that up against the fibromyalgia questionnaire, psychological questionnaire, it's the same list of problems in there, which incorporates the whole system. Breathing one side, cardiac function another, gut function another, sweating function being another. They're all sitting in there under the same list. They're
and
not separate entities.
You can't really separate them out.
We try. And therein lies my frustration with the system, where the gastroenterologist will look at the gut, cardiologist will look at the heart, the phrenologist will look at his kidneys.
Just in regard to sort of, let's call it mechanical lower back pain, he used to say, if you, I don't know if you still say it, I still use this with patients. if you take a car into the mechanic because it's blowing smoke, the mechanic goes, oh, let's replace the exhaust.
I still use that. I've gone even further now. Car's making a funny noise and all the front guards are dented and needs panel beating. Does fixing the panel fix the car noise? What you see on that scan is like having a dented panel. Panel beater will love to have a go at it, but it doesn't make a difference how the car functions. I love my cars, and this is exactly right. You know, what you see may not be, it can still look like rubbish, but drive extremely well, or it looks perfect and drives like rubbish, and everything in between. If you've restored a few cars, you'll know what I'm talking about.
So how does that actually look in the clinic for you?
And then the question is, from that then, how does breathing look in that, in terms of people are taught certain models of breathing?
Mm.
How does that look from your perspective, understanding what you understand now about core and about...
Very simple demonstrations. So stand up. Good, and then sit down. Now, when you stand up again, what are you doing with your breathing?
Well, the first time I didn't breathe, second time I inhaled.
Good, sit down again.
And I exhale.
Good. So stand up again, breathe in consciously, feels quite normal.
Yep.
Breathe out as you go down. Good. Okay, now stand up and breathe out.
I had to force it.
Harder work?
Yep.
Different.
Mm-hmm.
You slowed down too. You took time to think because the system was saying, I'm ready to do something else. You've told me to do something different.
Yeah.
And that's, again, as you breathe in, there's a diaphragm drops, pelvic floor elevates for continence. The abdominal wall does come in. It increases the intra-abdominal pressure by about 20 mil. As you breathe out, you lose that intra-abdominal pressure component, so it's harder work. It needs more muscle activity, which we tricked you. You didn't know what to do. Now, if you stand up for me, all right, watch out. We're going to make you jump. So jump high as you can. Go. You breathe in or breathe out?
First time I didn't do anything, second time I breathed in.
Okay, this time breathe in and jump. Go. Okay, now this time you're going to breathe out and jump. What's the difference?
I'm not sure, but I think maybe it was easier to jump breathing out.
Breathing out.
Yeah.
All right, close your eyes. As you jump, breathe in. Okay, keep your eyes closed. As you jump, breathe out. Breathe out, go. You wobbled more when you had your eyes closed.
Mm.
We can make you jump on one leg to make it more complex.
Remember, he's a kayak paddler, not a ballerina.
Not a ballerina. So if you jump on one leg, now breathe out and do it. Sit down before we hurt him. As you jump, if you breathe out, you haven't got the intra-abdominal pressure. It's more effort.
That shows how unaware I was. I wasn't really sure.
No, I think we've got it on video as well, how much you wobbled. That's
when
why
I
got your eyes closed.
I exhaled as I jumped.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah.
If you look at athletes, the same thing. Get him to do a task. As the task gets more complex, the system forces this inspiration model more and more to the point where if you try and exhale and do a complex task, the system goes, bugger it, I'm out of here.
Okay.
It doesn't respond. So this is what we started seeing with a lot of footballers. They'd be doing all their bracing, but then they go to jump and pick up a football, they're going to breathe in. They don't breathe out, or people start to interfere with it, and they'd fall over, and of course, they get injured. Whereas in the ballet world, the dance world, if you jump, you breathe in as you take off. Where the Pilates world got this from is there was a lot of contemporary dancers in Pilates in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and a lot of them went through Merce Cunningham, a woman called Martha Graham, and a large part of the modern dance world was about this relax, release technique, breathe out, exhale on activity, and that's where that breathing came from. So it was sort of more industry-led for one thing. You had the classical dancers who, well, you can't lift them, you can't jump if you breathe out. They just become like a sack of spuds, whereas the modern dancers were sack of spuds falling about on the floor.
Because we interviewed Simon Borg-Olivier, who's also a physio and very much involved in yoga, and the idea of that forced exhalation is so-called relaxing, and he was really strongly about teaching people how to breathe functionally again, because most people don't, because deep breathing is not correct breathing.
It's tidal volume, which is response, how much oxygen do you need in the system. So if you breathe really big breaths initially, then you stop, your system goes, I don't need to breathe for a while, so you stop breathing until you get back into stasis, go, okay, we can breathe now. Well, you go the other extreme, you know.
Less. Which is Wim Hof method, in essence, and you're doing that to produce those changes, but then rest, you don't do it while you're doing other things.
I'd be interested to see his thermoregulatory system driven by the autonomics as well to cope with cold, because that's another part of it, thermoregulation. There's all these things tie in. As you said, you know, there's a big push with this as far as exercising. I did mention the CrossFit P video, but is looking at what exercise patients are doing. Can you measure the outcome of it? And that's probably the big thing that we're driving at the moment is, first of all, can you measure a change in a person's function? You can measure pain if you want. That comes in if they're focused on pain. But if you can actually change a person's function very quickly, and we're talking within a session, then that means you can then design this exercise program very quickly and rapidly, which is what we're doing with the insurers at the moment. So we've published some of this, some of it's unpublished. We did look at this training programs, 2, 4, 6 weeks, changing proprioception, which is the big one with ACL knees, but just a lot of function. It's not strength, it's the balance proprioception side of things. Some of them they found made worse. This is unpublished as yet, but the Otago group looked at what we're doing with this single directional model and finding you get a 26.9% change very quickly, in fact within 16 minutes consistently, which backed up a lot of the pilot studies we'd been doing with footballers. We did stuff with EPL, Liverpool, clubs like this in the UK, and we found the same thing. We could change their function, measure it very quickly within session. So we're now applying that. If it works with footballers, we did this with the military, HMAS Cuttable up in Sydney, with the Defence Forces, got their guys back to work, which was Iraq, versus medcap them out, which they didn't want. They want to be in the field. So we've used this at high level, so we're just winding it back down now, and of course the dancers, winding it back down now to the general public, and finding this model is very easy to set up predictors for function.
It's a lot more than that in terms of, is it about learning how to breathe in the right way whilst you're doing it?
Ideally, your breathing should be automatic. It's one of those things, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. The second time, are they choreographing their breathing and doing the wrong thing? And that's where you interfere, going, no, just breathe through it. Don't try and force it and brace it. And you get a lot of people, athletes, well, they're bracing everything. You're trying to work really hard. And you go, you don't have to work hard. So we're looking at these efficiency models. Now, if you want to look at breathing, tennis. Now, there's one where forced expiration and making lots of grunts and noises was thought to be worthwhile. Don't see Federer grunt much, do you? How long's he lasted? Look at those efficient players, your Federers, your Sampras's, your Agassi's. They lasted a long time because they were very efficient. Federer got injured last year, hurt his knee putting the kids into the bath. That's it. You look at your power players that make all the noise and the grunt. You know, Nadal's power play is either very good or currently broken, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he is. He's been broken a lot recently.
Broken a lot. Nadal's pretty good. You don't hear him grunt and carry on a lot. Then there's the girls.
Screaming girls.
More psychological.
A lot of those players that are really loud, sure, than any of them have that massive longevity.
No.
They haven't been training people to scream while they're doing Pilates.
No, it's frowned upon.
Well, imagine doing that in ballet.
Yes, you're not allowed to scream on stage unless it's choreographed. And that's where, you know, you could pick up different sports and look at the noise, the grunting. Tennis has been a classic. Suddenly they all started grunting. How much effort are you putting in? But you look at the guys at the top of the tree, the best ones, they're not doing it.
I just thought about it in terms of paddling. If I'm doing athletics or something like that, and it's high cardiovascular, yes, I've got to inhale, but then I've got to exhale as well. I actually think about it, and I could be wrong, but the models you often get taught, you often hear a paddler and you'll hear when they're trying to regulate their breathing, sort of the steam train, so to speak. We've been taught to force this exhalation. I guess we should be taught to really emphasize the inhale and let the exhale just flow.
If you're putting in a lot of effort, it should feel like a lot of effort.
Simon Borg-Olivier's view was that if you're forcing it too much, then you send yourself massively into sympathetic dominance, whereas if you can learn to breathe normally at higher levels, then you're actually allowing yourself to stay less wound up, less in fight or flight.
And it's, again, it's that regulation of oxygenation, simple way of putting it. How much oxygen do you need in the system to function at that level, for one, as well as looking at cardiac function, so you've got cardiovascular function that goes along with it, intra-abdominal pressure, sort of how stable or how functionally are you affecting, and this is where the people doing the big weight movements, we looked at a lot of this with stingers. Classic, you know, you get the basal breathers, the diaphragm breathers, and you get the belly breathers, and these are the ones that sort of let the belly flop out so they can get their diaphragm lower, believing that's what's going to work. I haven't seen a diaphragm in your guts for a while.
I remember those aqua singers when I was working with you, is that the core stability thing was completely contradictory to what they were doing.
But the reason they were in was because they had back pain, they had problems. Sad to see some of these major opera singers. Pavarotti, his back was completely cactus. I went to his last concert here with the Melbourne Symphony and he was in a wheelchair, literally lost his power. His back had gone, he'd had several surgeries, failed. Were you here when looked after Beauty and the Beast, Hugh Jackman?
No.
The incident in the Crimson Tights, I think he talks about it too. The belly breather that loses continence. And of course when you piss yourself in Crimson Tights, the whole Princess Theatre sees it. I think he talks about it too now. You know, we saw this a lot of the opera singers with episodes of continence. Oh, Fergie from the Black Eyed Peas, that's a video that's floating around. There's a lot of this goes on where the way they're breathing does affect their continence, and of course they run into strife.
You're saying belly breathing is not necessarily the way it goes. So how would one diaphragm breathe? I guess a lot of people would say my diaphragm contracts downward, my belly expands like a balloon. How would we diaphragm breathe functionally?
Your diaphragm breathe is basal breathing. So the thing that holds your ribs down is your external obliques. So they're not holding your rib cage down. You can basally expand, but at the same time, as you inhale, your normal response is diaphragm descends and pelvic floor elevates.
Yeah.
So it's that contra pressure there, it's expanding. It's intrathoracic rather than intra-abdominal expansion.
Okay. Different to using your chest and shoulders.
Up here. So
we don't want to do that.
You don't do upper thoracic. And we saw this with a lot of the singer dancers. You can't belly breathe and dance in a skimpy costume.
Yeah.
What's an example? Ever seen Chicago? Now, if you're belly breathing, well, you're wearing high heels, fishnets, leotard, and a small top. The last thing you're going to be able to do is let your belly drop out while you're singing and dancing. So you've got to be able to maintain and breathe at the same time and move and dance.
Mm.
And this is where we start looking at the musicals. The breathing has to be combined with their movement.
So it's interesting, you had a quote that where you said in an email to us, and Matt made a quote a bit better, that core stability is dead, it never worked anyway, and we've discussed that today. Yet the other thing I wasn't expecting coming here today was to then understand that belly breathing, because I teach diaphragm breathing, and one way we describe it is to imagine the belly expanding. I didn't expect was to come here today to also learn that belly breathing is dead, that it doesn't work, that it's actually basal breathing.
But at the same time, if you've got a static model, if you're just sitting where you don't have to be stable and functioning, that's going to be able to work. But as soon as then you incorporate movement into the system, going, right, I've got to use these muscles, I've got to use this system, this intra-abdominal pressure model to maintain function. So what you may do in a static situation isn't going to carry over into a movement situation.
Yeah.
Your system is going to kick in going, I'm going to do this, and we can't override that. The automatics come into it.
More natural breathing.
Yeah.
And you mentioned before that a lot of the abdominal muscles and a lot of the so-called core muscles are controlled by thoracic spine, not lumbar spine.
Yeah.
So that would also tie back into diaphragm breathing as actual basal breathing, not belly breathing.
Yeah, because the diaphragm basically attaches to the lower intercostal margin.
Yeah.
Phrenic nerve contracts that muscle. As that muscle contracts, it expands.
Yeah.
So that's the active component. The passive component, of course, is the elastic recoil.
So we're looking to expand into here, aren't we?
So it's just expanding
our lower ribs
sideways there without letting all this hang out. It's the shot you do as you walk past the window, you know. Pull that in, yep, good on you, I look better there, rather than letting it hang out.
But we're definitely not looking for this one. We're not looking for... That one we're looking for.
Your upper lobes have nowhere near the capacity as the basal lobes, so that upper thoracic breathing's certainly less efficient.
Well, it's emergency breathing from my understanding.
Yeah, sort of the bit left over. If we're looking at that basal expansion, you can tie the autonomics into that, because if you're getting good basal expansion, it's actually going to be moving the thoracic spine, and this accord is where the thoracic cord runs, which is the predominant part of the autonomic nervous system. So there's no autonomics in the lumbar spine, but where you've got cord, that will affect sympathetic outflow, because you've got the ganglia feeding straight in from the sympathetic chain into the spinal cord, and that's where you get this thing with mechanical function. There's a large amount of research on this at the moment. Menina Schmidt, professor of neurosciences at Oxford University, Swiss physio, did her PhD here in Australia, Queensland Uni, but she's looked at this immune-mediated response with neurocompression. What it's meaning, basically, if you squash a nerve, you'll get an immune system response. And this is the big word floating around out there at the moment, is an immune system response, but nobody understands it. She now has published this. It is understood. It may take 10, 15, 20 years to get out there, but trauma will drive an immune response.
Basically, if I learn how to breathe functionally, basally, learning how to breathe using my diaphragm properly, that'll have an impact on my thoracic spine in terms of my posture, which then will have a positive impact on my immune system.
Could it be that simple?
And the opposite, if I do it completely incorrectly, then I
could trigger it off. Yeah. And this is where we've looked at a lot of this stuff with trauma to the thoracic spine, triggering this response. Good posture is not always a good thing if you have an extension trauma. We've had this with the military, with bomb explosions, where they've been exploded from behind. We've had this with AFL, getting a knee in the back, going up for a big specky, and then, just feel a bit weird after all this, mate, and a bit emotional and my guts don't work. In fact, what's happened is they've had cord trauma. You see this with also spinal cord units. It's well published about spinal cord, spinothoracic cord, brainstem trauma affecting the autonomics. If you put an exercise system in that tries to posture correct or extend, in that case someone who's had an extension trauma, it's going to end in tears, and usually does. So they need an exercise program basically opposing the trauma in lots of flexion. As I said, we see this with bomb disposal guys we've had from the Navy, and of course they get blown 10 metres in a bomb suit. That's an extension trauma. We've had it with firefighters, same sort of thing. So that comes very much into how these autonomics trigger. You see it with car accidents, extension trauma, big rear ender, people going off backwards into trees. Got one of those at the moment.
And whiplash, and the psychological problems that emanate from that are huge. It's not something that you can think your way out of.
No.
And putting that on people that I'm not managing to think my way out of these emotional problems.
Well, there's multiple layers to the emotional problem. One is the fact that everyone tells you it must be in their head because they can't put a tissue structure against that.
Which is what happens with so many people with your chronic fatigues and fibromyalgia and IBS, is they end up so helpless.
And at the same time, if you actually then look at the fact that in amongst all this you have increased adrenoreceptor response, which is drives the anxiety side of things. We went through before, I'll have a chat to God about that down regulator in the adrenal cortex. Pump so much adrenaline into the system that you get this wound up, anxious, hypervigilant individual who then goes into adrenal fatigue. They're absolutely buggered and they just wipe out. But then they can't sleep, go the other extreme, because then they're not getting melatonin secretion.
And the hypothalamus regulates their sleep cycles.
Funny about that. So you put it all together and join the dots, and this is the thing of being able to join the dots. What drives this whole system, and somebody comes along and just gives it a whack and the wiring goes haywire, then off it goes. I think it's quite exciting. There's a lot of this research now out there that provides the understanding, and I'm working with a number of doctors on this at the moment because they're very expensive, very difficult patients for the normal medical system. They don't respond to medication. And at the same time, if you look at the individual organs, we're trying to get gastroenterologists to talk to cardiologists to talk to, you know, you could be here all day, couldn't you? Every other ologist, rheumatologist, to actually then combine the knowledge to come up with it. So I've got a group of doctors at the Gold Coast that are trying to do this, and we're working in with them.
Pilates developed it originally, Joseph Pilates, to work with these traumatised.
Interesting. Funny about that. If you look back at the original injury model, you know, a lot of springs and slings. I mean, that was Mrs. Olive Guthrie Smith started that just after the First World War. But at the same time, simple exercise tools, getting people exercising, by chance maybe came across the fact that these guys hadn't thought of that. Explosion traumas.
Young German soldiers, post-war, you can't imagine the trauma.
And actually talking about it now, it makes sense with what we've been doing with the military here. It's almost going full cycle. These guys want to get back to active service. They've had failed discectomies, they've had failed surgeries, and they're at age 31 looking at a very expensive MedCat, categorised medically unfit for active service, and we've been able to turn them around, and these are strong blokes. Well, they think they're strong, carrying 22, 30 kilos of armour, sidearms, Kevlar, God knows what. They're weighed down massively, they're just not capable. If you look at it, the same thing. It's been a simple exercise program that holds up. And that's where simplicity, not complexity, is the big one. Exercise has been there. The culture physique era of the turn of the 20th century, which was the Pilates era. It wasn't alone. There was a lot of those guys. But at the same time, it's sort of going full circle from medical technology back to something that's actually quite simple. And the fact now that we can measure it.
And via the ballet dancers who took it up because it worked.
Took it up because it worked and did this model with shows because they had 8 shows a week. It's like having 8 footy games a week. They're up there pushing it. We had to make fast decisions.
That's right.
Got all those posters up there on Sunset Boulevard. You remember when we did, what was it, Starlight Express? The roller skating one. High speed trauma. Guys coming off roller skates at high speed. So a lot of those things we had to make the rapid decisions, decide whether we keep them on or get them off. And the same thing, you know, you can't put everybody off for a week's rest. You have no show.
Ballet dancers, performers, they don't respond to that.
No.
Footy players, you say, oh, it's going to be 3 weeks and they grizzle, but they do it. Mm. Ballet dancers go, I'm dancing tomorrow night. And you go, you don't understand, this is 3 weeks. And they go, no, you don't understand. I'm dancing tomorrow night. Okay.
Yeah, and they'll do it. So, yeah, that's the sort of the story of it. The breathing is a big one in all of this because it sort of gives you an insight there's something not right, and then it's asking the questions, in which case maybe a simple fix, could you've just been trained inappropriately, you've sort of been told to do all this force stuff, and there's no big problem there versus the list of, well, it's not just the breathing. I've got this, yeah. And I've got this. And people often try and discount it or pass it off and things like that, but you find underneath all this, you've got this whole big list of autonomic disturbance that's actually drawing you in there.
I think the breathing can be a good little measure in the sense, or a good little feedback system if you've got a model, whether it be a model of a way to move or a model of anything, and it's contrary to allowing natural breathing, then maybe there's something flawed in the model.
Yeah.
And I guess with Pilates over time, it's come full circle that way and all it's evolved.
And that's what makes it clinical Pilates, I guess, is that you're constantly examining it.
It's trying to put it into a clinical context to say, well, here's a tool that's, don't reinvent the wheel. Here's an exercise model that has been around for a long time, and things won't stay around for long if they don't work well. But it's sort of stood the test at times. I said we've put it under the blowtorch. We've had research done on this. Independently, I'll help start setting up the project, then I'll get sent away. So I can't interfere. So we've done randomized controlled trials of this. We've done innovator reliability. We've done validity studies with it. We've put it to the test with athletes. We've put it to the test with the military.
How long do you think it takes to get to the Pilates instructor out in the burbs?
It'll take a long time. And again, it's a case of that model getting through, being used at the clinical level we're doing with physios, getting people going. So once you establish, right, here's this person's program model, which is different to the others, it's then carrying that through. So then we're looking exactly this at the moment with the health insurers going, well, if we can keep that person out of surgery, how do we keep them out of surgery for the next 5, 10, 15 years? So it's when they get to the gyms, to the Pilates instructors, that they've got a model of care that actually fits them specifically. And by that stage, it may not matter. They've basically been fitted, and this is where they're all being heterogenized into different subgroups, as opposed to one model fits all. We get that individual program for this person versus, no, this person's okay now to do their exercise. So it's encouraging that exercise thing, which is a big part of keeping people functioning. A lot of people try exercise with the best of intentions and they go off and hurt themselves, versus the ones that go and do exercise, good, they get better for doing something rather than nothing. That's the 80% taking up a small part of the funding, 20%, and then we look at the other model on top of that. The next 20 years will be interesting.
Yes,
it'll be very interesting.
It's only been 30 years so far, hasn't it?
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Matt. Enjoyed it.